Well, I know a lot of people are going to be buying some bubbly to toast the new year this weekend. You used to see those bottles marked champagne, and that was pretty much it. Now you see Cava and Prosecco and others, and we'll talk about the differences today with our guest. Rob Lewis is the Le Cordon Bleu certified sommelier, a member of the U.S. Sommelier Association, Society of Wine Educators, and the French Wine Society. He's a winemaker, owns Lewis Station Winery, and he's also the owner of the Vino School, Wisconsin Wine School, and the Midwest Sommelier School. So he knows a lot, and you may well have some questions or maybe some experiences to share. I'd love to hear those as well. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email at talk@WPR.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Rob, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me.
You have a list of titles and accomplishments here. How'd you get so interested in wine?
Well, quite honestly, it probably goes back to 2004. I mean, I was a wine drinker before then. I enjoyed the Asti Spumantes and the Proseccos, and I was with a friend of mine who was a wine merchant at the time, and in 2004. We went out to a restaurant and he said, "All right, so I'm going to buy the bottle of wine, but you have to promise to drink it." And I was obviously willing to drink it. So we had a pizza, and it was a 2001 Nyers Zinfandel. And I thought it was going to be a white Zinfandel because that's what I used to drink. And I thought there was something wrong with the glass because it came out and it was really dark. And I'm like, so what is this? And so he proceeded to tell me about what Zinfandel is and what I should be expecting to smell and all of that. And I can tell you, at that moment, I learned what 1 + 1 is 3 or more. Because the wine was fabulous. The pizza was delicious. But you put the two together, it was incredible. It was a mind-blowing experience for me. And after that, I decided that, you know what, I need to learn a little bit more about wine because it had such an impact on my life.
And some difficult classes? Those are...
Yeah, well, so I went to Le Cordon Bleu to be a sommelier. And most sommeliers work in fine dining restaurants, working with chefs. My intent wasn't really to do that. It was really just to give me more education so that I would have the opportunity, one, to learn more and understand the history of wine, but also that I could start my own class and start my own school, which I did with the Wisconsin Wine School, and start teaching adults about wine, to kind of take away the de-snob, kind of de-snobify the wine, to make it real for everyone so that they could really enjoy wine.
And you make your own wines as well?
I do, yeah. So in 2008, my wife and I, we started a little wine shop. And so I hand-selected wines from around the world. And I had finished Le Cordon Bleu, and I knew I needed to take that next step. And my wife, she bought me a wine kit for Christmas. And I had so much fun with the wine kit that I ended up buying so many wine kits. I ended up throwing the directions away that... I'd make wine out of the wine kit, throw the directions away just based on what I was smelling and tasting, and I decided that I needed to pursue my education, so I went through UC Davis and the VESTA program, which is Viticulture, Enology, Science, Technology, and Alliance. Went through that program to really learn about winemaking so I could learn the science behind what I was already creating.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, and in 2011, I was like, all right, it's time to go to that next step. So that's when we opened
here
the wine.
Here you are.
And here I am, yeah.
Well, why are we seeing fewer bottles that say champagne?
Well, you know what? That's a good question. So champagne obviously has been around for a long time. Champagne is the northernmost region in France. And champagne, so if you see champagne on the label, champagne is a place name. So as with most French wines, the wines like Burgundy and Bordeaux, those are all place names. Now, once you start to learn about wine, you learn what grapes grow in those in those regions, and you know what to expect. But so champagne, when you see champagne on the bottle, generally speaking, it is going to come from that region of France. Although, so all champagnes are sparkling wines, but not all sparkling wines are champagne.
Okay.
So you had mentioned earlier about cava. So cava is a wine that's produced in Spain. Actually, it's one of my favorites. I love Spanish cava. But then you also have, in Germany, you have Zecht. You have the Spumantes. You have the Moscato di Asti. You have all of those types of sparkling wine that, for most of them, they're all produced in the same method, although there are different methods of production for a sparkling wine. And that's where the cost variance comes from, you know, the different bottles.
You know, Leslie in La Crosse called in to ask why homemade wines are so silky, as Leslie described it, as compared to wine you buy in the store. She thinks the homemade wines are from kits, and probably likely most of them are.
Yeah, so most of them probably are, although there are a lot of home winemakers that have vineyards, small vineyards that they're producing grapes. Certainly here in Wisconsin, we do a lot of fruit wines with, with apples and pears and cherries specifically. But you do find that with a kit wine, when you're using juice that's already been produced and put in bags and shipped to you and sat on a shelf somewhere for a while, that they start to lose some of the elements of the tannin structure of the wine or the mouthfeel of the wine. Now, as a winemaker, there are things you can do to influence that with oak and some other things. But in general, she is correct.
Yeah. And so you know exactly what she was saying when she said silky.
I knew exactly what she was saying. Absolutely.
Well, here's Mike in Castle Rock. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling. We got Mike on here? For some reason, let's get him on.
A bunch like that.
I'm sorry, Mike. Would you start again?
Oh, yes. Well, I want you to talk about vintage wines. I have vintage wines in the basement. I've got Chateau Lafite, et cetera. And the corks. I'd like you to talk about the corks, recorking some of the stuff that I've got.
So you're saying you use some of the bottle and then you want to cork it again?
No, you can't do that.
You can't do that.
No. What happens is over the years, the corks, I don't want to say disintegrate, but they let oxygen in, or they can.
Yeah.
And they should be recorked. But I wondered if your guest and comment on that. You may not even know. I don't know.
Well, thanks for calling, Mike. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, no, that's actually a great question. And that Chateau Lafite that you just mentioned, you could bring that up to the studio, and I'd be more than happy to share that with you, because that's a fabulous French wine. But so anyway, as true with sparkling wine, it's true with all wines that the vintage wines themselves, they're only as good as the cork itself. So in most cases, the cork will start to, it'll disintegrate. Exactly what you said, that happens. And as wine ages, the cork does allow some oxygen to penetrate into the wine. In fact, a lot of the corks that are designed today are designed in a way that it's supposed to allow a little bit of oxygen into the wine over an extended period of time, because that's what actually helps the wine mature and get ready for consumption. Now, so I have heard of people that do recork the wine. Now, you need that needs to be obviously a quick process, and I know that there are companies actually that if you search online that would actually provide that service for you, but essentially they remove the cork, they top the top of the bottle with argon gas, because argon is a nice blanket for the top of the wine to protect it from oxygen, and argon will not be absorbed into the wine, but like carbon dioxide would. So there are services out there for that. What's most important, though, with the health of the cork and the bottle is to keep it in a nice, dark basement at a consistent temperature around 60 degrees, plus or minus a little bit, with nice humidity so that the cork not only stays moist on the inside, but actually has a little humidity, a little moisture on the outside, because a moist cork will kind of keep it intact versus it drying out and allowing more oxygen in.
Hmm. There we go. Mike, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, talking about wines and sparkling wines today with our guest, Rob Lewis. Great to have him along. And again, call in, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. The names you see on bottles, extra brewed, brewed, extra dry, demi-sec, what are the meanings of all of those?
Yeah, great question. There are actually seven different classifications of the champagne itself, and it relates to sweetness. So if you look at Brut Nature, that is a wine that would have 0 to 0.3, so it wouldn't even be detectable on your palate. So you got, as you mentioned, extra brut, brut, and then you have extra dry and dry. Now you think dry wine is, when you see it on a champagne bottle, you would think that it's dry or not sweet, but actually it has up to 3% sugar, so it is sweet. And then you have demi-sec. So generally speaking, what you see out on the shelves at your local liquor store or Costco or whatever is the two most common would be Brut, and Brut would be dry, or you would see demi-sec, and demi-sec would be kind of a semi-sweet.
Oh, there we go.
Yep.
Let's go to Kyle in Dubuque. Kyle, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hey, this is a great program. A friend of mine, Bob, told me to tune on in and hear about this. And you guys are going into a lot of great things. I have the fortune of being dating a woman who's a sommelier, so she's always introducing me to wines that I probably have no business getting into. I'm still a guinea pig here, but I love it. She's got a great taste. And one thing I've noticed on certain wines when I go to buy wine, which is a challenge for me because I have to come up with something good, some of these corks that are like plasticized, I'm curious if that is a sign of a cheap wine or if that just is, you know, I don't know what that means exactly, but you find a cork differ, and a real cork is kind of what I'm maybe looking for. I don't know if that tells you anything.
Oops, we lost him somehow. Go ahead.
Yep, well, I kind of got the gist of his question. Is that and he's right. There are a lot of different corks out there. So there are some the traditional old corks that you can find through different types of cork that actually they take the cork and they grind it down to like a sawdust and then re-glue it back together, reconstitute it, which is actually a really good cork for storing. There's a variety of synthetic corks. There's a cork out there called Zork, which is a plastic cork that's got like a little seal cap on it. And then, of course, you have screw caps. So there are a lot of different varieties that you're going to see when you go out and look on the shelves and look at corks. So the question becomes is, you know, is it a sign of quality as it relates to one cork over the other? So here's kind of the nutshell of it. There's a lot of new technology that's in place now that some of the synthetic corks and some of the corks that are made with sugarcane, in fact, they are designed in a way to mirror some of the best corks that you can buy. Now, I have kind of an interesting perspective on this because I'm a winemaker too. So I am someone that always, I'm not a wine purist.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm willing to explore options. And I started with a natural cork. I went to a synthetic cork. I even tried that Zork that I mentioned. And now I'm using corks that are 100% green. And they're called Neocork. And they're made from sugarcane. And they are actually designed to protect the wine as if it were a fine wine that you would buy. And you know what's interesting when you say is it cheap or not? The price of the cork, the 100% cork is very porous. So if you can grab it and you can squeeze it and it's like a sponge, that's going to allow more oxygen in. Whereas some of the synthetic corks are going to be a little more harder and they're going to prevent oxygen. Those are actually more expensive to the producer to buy. Hmm. So from the consumer side, you know, there is this romance with having that cork in the bottle. Although with new technology, with some of the new corks that I mentioned, it's certainly worth exploring. You know, it goes back to like a couple decades ago when in California we started doing wines with screw caps. And,
yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, the first producers were the jug wines with screw caps, right? So that kind of gave that perception that anything that's not cork must be a cheap wine. But what's interesting is now some of the most expensive wines in California are screw caps because they actually protect the wine exceptionally well. And back then, the French said, we will never use a screw cap. But if you go to your shelf at the liquor store and look at French wines, about half of them have screw caps now. So
there you go,
it's
Rob.
It's about protecting the juice.
Rob Lewis, our guest today, Le Cordon Bleu certified sommelier, owner and winemaker of Lewis Station Winery, among other things. Our guest here, hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, we'll talk with the author of a new book that tells the story of a group of remarkable women who expanded what we know about the universe and whose discoveries, even though they happened back in around 1890, are still being used today. Right now, taking a look at wines and zeroing a little bit on sparkling wines, but it looks like we're taking more wine questions sort of than sparkling wine questions right now with Rob Lewis. Great to have him along, and certainly join in at 1-800-642-1234. And let's turn to Bob in Wauwatosa. Bob, hello. Thank you for calling. Let's see. Why am I? Okay, here we go.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I've got a question about wine that is made with real corks. Is it okay to store those bottles on their side to keep the cork moist so it doesn't loosen up?
Bob, that is exactly what you should do. So you want to keep that cork moist. So the idea is to do exactly as you suggest. You store the wine in your basement. I mean, if you have a wine cellar, that's great, but we're blessed here in the state of Wisconsin, actually the upper Midwest, Minnesota, Northern Illinois, and Michigan, that we have the perfect weather and temperature that if you have a nice dark spot in your basement, you store the wines on their side, specifically with the corks. You want to keep it moist so that it doesn't dry out. So you're doing the right thing.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's see. Let's turn next to Duane in Weston. Duane, hello. Thanks for calling.
You bet. Great show. Great topic. I had a question and a comment about, like, when you go to buy wine, they'll have, like, a lot of times they'll have a little placard above certain types of wine, like the 2013, you know, Spags, you know, great gold medal winner. But then all what's up there is 2014s. And also, so do people pay attention to the year of vintage, and do they know that it can be, is there a lot of drastic difference? And second, do like Sonoma and Napa consistently make better wines than other regions, you know?
Okay. All right. What do you think, Rob?
Yeah, actually, very good questions. Let's address the second question first because I remember it. So with Sonoma and Napa, you know, it's based on preference. So one thing that you find with Sonoma and Napa is that here in the U.S., they were pioneers with some of the French varieties that came across, like the Cabernets and the Sauve Blancs and Rieslings and Merlots, et cetera. So what you find is that, again, it's about preference. So if you're somebody that likes big fruit with higher alcohol content, which means, you know, 14% or greater, you would look for wines that are in hotter climate regions, like you find in Napa and Sonoma. Now, those same grape varieties are grown in Bordeaux. That's actually where they originate in northern France. And the climate is different there, or what we call the terroir is a little bit different there. And as a result, the wine tastes different. So it's kind of hard to put a Bordeaux next to a California Cabernet and say which one's better, A or B. It's really about preference. Now, the first question
had to do, let's see, I'm suddenly blanking out.
Years of vintage.
Oh, years of vintage.
Years of vintage, yeah.
Okay, so years of, again, as with every question, it could be loaded. It could be two-sided. So does vintage matter? It does. So, again, I had just mentioned terroir. And terroir essentially is everything that Mother Earth brings to the vine that year. So it could be how much sunshine, how much rain, how much wind, when the winemaker chose to pick the grapes, at what sugar content. I mean, there's just so many varieties that relate to terroir. On really great years, where all the conditions are right, the fruit can be, everything could be in balance. The acidities and the sugars and everything could be in balance, that the end result that the winemaker creates is just an incredible wine. And that's why you can look at, like, Wine Spectator and some of those other magazines and look how people rate wines, that you can have the same winery, like Frog's Leap, that one year their Zinfandel rated a 91, and then the following year it rated a 96 or something.
Yeah.
So it's about personal preference.
Sure.
Now, most go ahead.
Well, I just saying, I used to demo wine. I still do on occasion, but I always told customers that if you buy a bottle of wine and you can't taste it first and it's not up to what you like, I said, at least have some hors d'oeuvres with it, and it enhances the wine, and, you know, both vice versa. And they, you know, I think that's true too, you know.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, pairing food with wine is, that's one of the things that I love to talk about. That's mm-hmm. when I'm teaching classes, those are the things that can really make a wine fantastic. But what I was mentioning is that, so not only is can you look at a date and look at vintage and see the price variance, but there are a lot of wines out there that are non-vintage. And that's true certainly with almost all sparkling wines and all champagne wines is they're non-vintage, meaning that they carry over juice from year to year so that every year when they produce that wine, it's very similar. So so that's where they consider non-vintage. Now, occasionally you'll find some champagne wines where the winery chose to put a vintage on it. And when you have a champagne wine specifically that has a vintage, know that it's going to cost a little more.
Mm-hmm.
But that goes back to that year was such an incredible year for the terroir and for the rain and for everything else that wine was so good when they chose to make a cuvée, which is like right after they press it, that first juice, that they decided to make that a vintage wine because it's going to be a classic wine that'll mature.
Interesting. Duane, thank you. Appreciate the call. Just to follow up on that, on the bubblies. First, how are the bubbles in sparkling wine created? How do they do that?
That's a good question because they're not all sparkling wines are created equal. So in Champagne, the wines are made in the method champenoise, which is a term that can only be used in Champagne, but it's the traditional method. And essentially how that works now is that they do a first fermentation in the tank or in the oak barrel. And once they bottle the wine, they do a second fermentation in the bottle where they add just a little more sugar and a little more yeast, and then they close it off. And what that does is it creates CO2 in the wine itself. So that's kind of that traditional method. Now, when you step outside of Champagne and you look at other regions in France, they produce using the same method, but it's called Cremant. So if you see that on the label, then you know it's actually made in France using the same method, but they can't call it Champagne because it's not in the region of Champagne. So that's why you can't go to Burgundy and buy a Bordeaux because mm-hmm. it's a different region. You don't do that. Now, like I had mentioned earlier that I really enjoy cava from Spain. They make the cava in the traditional method. So there are plenty of regions and wineries that produce wines in that traditional method, like Gruet in New Mexico, which is one of my favorite wineries. They do just an incredible job. And the wines that I'm name-dropping a little bit, but those are names... and those are wines that I would recommend because, one, anywhere up here in the Midwest, you'll be able to go to maybe not your corner liquor store, but a store that might have a larger wine selection. You'll find those wines there. So it's
And repeat those again for me, the ones that
Oh, absolutely. Well, so Gruet, G-R-U-E-T, Gruet is out of New Mexico. All they do is champagne, and they've got a Brut Rosé that... is probably $15, but it tastes like a $40 champagne. I mean, it's really good. So that's certainly one that I would recommend. Scharfenberger, which is out of California, they do a great job. In Napa, there's a producer called Mumm, M-U-M-M. The family kind of originates in Champagne, so they have... 600-700 years of experience in Champagne, but they're producing some great vino in California. So just off the top of my head, those are a few.
We'll give our listeners a chance to join in again. Some open lines will get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. The champagnes, I had a champagne, and I was at a relative's house on Christmas Day, which was very good, and I didn't even look at the bottle. I enjoyed it a lot. It was served pretty cold. Is that mm-hmm. the proper temperature for serving a sparkling wine?
Yeah, great question. So of all the wines that you would drink, champagne is the one, or sparkling wines would be the one that you want to drink the coldest.
Yeah.
So to get your champagne or your sparkling wine ready for consumption, you'd want to put it in your refrigerator for at least a couple hours prior to opening the bottle. Or you'd want to at least put it in a bucket of ice for 20 sure. to 30 minutes because you want to have a nice chill on it. And the reason that that's important with sparkling wines specifically is that there's compressed CO2 inside that bottle,
mm-hmm.
and the colder it is, that champagne, the less wine loss that you're going to have when you open it.
So if you
open a champagne bottle that's room temperature, you're going to spill it everywhere. But if it's nice and cold, it actually contains it into the bottle. So we haven't talked about opening it yet. So I thought I'd just mention that real quick. So again, you want it really cold. When you take the metal cage off of it, it's exactly six twists on that little metal cage, and you pop it off. So as soon as you take the cage off, you always want to make sure you have your hand on the cap. Mm-hmm. All right, so you want to keep your hand on the cork because it's anywhere from 70 to 95 pounds per square inch inside that bottle. So if it corks and you're not controlling it, it's shooting 65 miles an hour across the room, which can be entertaining, but you could hurt somebody or lose some wine. But so essentially what you do is you'd hold the bottle at 45 degrees, and you hold the cork with one hand, and with your other hand, you gently twist the bottle until the cork comes off. Now, if you stand it upright too soon, the fizzle start coming out. All you got to do is just turn that bottle back to 45 degrees, and it'll stop. And the reason for that is that carbon dioxide is trying to breathe. It's trying to kind of escape out of the bottle. So if you're holding it straight upright, there's only about an inch of surface diameter for that CO2 to escape. So that's why it's going to come out in juice. Turn it on its side a little bit, and you won't lose any wine. How about that?
I like that. That's a great tip. Barbara in Mount Horeb has a question. Barbara, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I found a really specific grape that I like, Pinotage from South Africa. And I think it's a pretty limited region, and I was wondering why Some of the bottle that I like a lot, but it's pretty expensive. When I've tried a lesser expensive Pinotage from South Africa, it's almost undrinkable. So for me, what makes a specific grape from a specific region change from, if it's 100% of that wine, from winemaker to winemaker?
You know, that's actually a great question. One, I'm with you on Pinotage. That's one of those grape varieties that is kind of undiscovered, and it's where you it's fortunate that you've found that grape variety, because it's a genetic offshoot of Pinot Noir, so it's got a lot of potential. It's actually a really good wine. It's not just Pinotage, but that goes back to every wine. So it really depends on a lot of different influences, and terroir is certainly part of it. So 100% Cabernet or 100% Pinotage from one vineyard across the street to another vineyard, they're going to taste different. And they're going to taste different because of the type of soil that it was grown in, the type of rain or runoff that it has, the day that they chose to pick the wine, whether they picked it too soon or too late. And certainly from the winemaker's perspective, there's manipulation that can take place where you can add more oak, add less oak, add Hungarian oak or French oak, and all these different things that actually changes the complexity of the wine and changes the taste of the wine. So it's one thing to recognize is that, you know, somebody can say, oh, I love Cabernet, but that doesn't mean 100% every bottle of Cabernet is going to taste the same, because it won't. And that goes true when I've talked to people that have come into the winery and they're like, oh, I hate Riesling. It's like, well, that means you had a bad experience with a Riesling. So let's try something else. Let's kind of explore. So it can be challenging, but when you find a producer that has what you're looking for, that you really enjoy, I would say talk to the sommelier or the wine merchant where you're buying it. And depending on where you're buying it, there's some really good educated people that can kind of steer you to a bottle that's going to taste very, very similar at a fraction of the cost.
Okay. And there's one, just one champagne corking. Many actually have lost light fixtures. So it's just, very exciting. Can be very exciting.
Yeah.
Thanks for those tips.
Yeah, better than an eyeball. So that's good.
Yeah. I see the ad. There was an ad on TV a while back where there was a young guy opening a bottle of champagne, and a person with a patch over one eye.
that can happen.
Oh my goodness me! Well, the food. We haven't gotten to food, and I want to, before we go back to the phones, have you mentioned a few things that you enjoy serving with champagne, for example?
No, absolutely. So food is really important as it relates not just to champagne, but as it relates to wine in general. There are components of food and wine that work well together. So one thing to recognize is that with most wines, you're going to have some sort of acidity, and that's what causes you to salivate when you take a drink of it. Well, there are foods out there that do the same thing, that when you take a bite of the food, like tomatoes is kind of your classic example, that you start to salivate, especially if the tomato's in season. So one thing that is very important when you're pairing food and wines is to find some complementary like that. So if you're having a champagne that when you taste it, you start to salivate, well, then you would obviously, you know, pair that with foods. It could be a piece of shrimp with a little splash of lemon, because that lemon adds some acidity, and that creates balance. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing is you have wines that are dry, that are tannic, and that could be even a rosé, a sparkling wine that's a rosé, or a champagne that's a rosé, because that rosé is made with, if it's in champagne anyway, it's made with Pinot Noir, most likely. And so that adds a little tannin structure, which means then you can pair that with chicken. I mean, there are classic pairings for champagne. Certainly lobster and drawn butter. You know, who doesn't like that, right? So that's a classic pairing. But I can tell you, a couple years ago, I had a Brut Rosé. So it's a dry rosé. It was made with Pinot Noir. And I had it with a dry rub ribs. And it was fantastic. It was great. So part of it is you got to taste and you got to experiment. But one thing to recognize is that there are elements and components in food and wine that if you pair those well together, they're incredible together.
Gunnar and Parade of Sheen, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hi. I have a farmhouse that has a cistern in it that I've been told would make a great wine cellar, and we like red wines, drier ones, anywhere from like a Cabernet or something. And I was wondering how you go about choosing a wine to store down there, you know, without spending a ton of money on them anyway.
Yeah.
No, so that's a good question. So there are grape varieties that will store longer than other grape varieties. So again, assuming that the condition is right, where you have a nice cool temperature that's pretty dark, so sunlight is not good for aging bottles of wine, and various temperature degrees that go up and down frequently is not very good with wine too for storing. So assuming all the conditions are right for storage, meaning, you know, nice cool temperature, it's dark, it's you know, that's damp. There are grape varieties that grow or that will store longer. Cabernet is one of those. Something to consider is that grape varieties that are high in tannin are higher in red skin. So that's where essentially your tannin comes from. Those wines will store longer. So like your Cabernet Sauvignon, your Cabernet Franc, your Merlot, your Petite Syrah specifically, Pinotage, Pinot Noir is a little bit lighter skin, but it can store, given the right conditions, but not as long as like your Cabernet. So, and generally speaking, your white wines won't store as long, except for wines that are high in acidity, because acidity is also a preservative. So if your wine is high in acidity, so some of your white wines, like your German dry Rieslings, some of the oldest wines on record are German dry Rieslings, and they're still incredible. So again, there's a lot of variances, so that's kind of what I would encourage you to store in your cellar. Again, that would be something that you'd want to drink. You know, most wines right now are made for immediate consumption. So that's something you'd want to take a look at when you look at the label. Most wineries or winemakers now will put on the label, you know, best served in, you know, 2022 or something. A lot of that has to do with the natural preservatives that might be part of that wine that would allow it to age, for example, like tannins. So, but if you go to this, you know, the local store and you get a $7 bottle of Cabernet, you know, 10 years from now, it's probably going to taste like a $2 bottle of Cabernet. So again, it's just something to consider.
And thank you so much for calling. And Rob, I didn't get through half the questions I have. I hope you'll come back and be with us again. Love to have you back.
I'd love to come back.
Rob Lewis, our guest today, owner and winemaker of Lewis Station Winery. We have a link on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. He is also owner of Vino School, Wisconsin Wine School, and the Midwest Sommelier School. Great to have him along, and we'll look forward to another visit from him. Tell you what, you might want to get a bottle of champagne and sit down with a new book that I found really interesting. It's called The Glass Universe, Women of the Harvard Observatory, and we'll talk with the author of that book, Dave Sobel, next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.